Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, Deep Space Nine. It's a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed about having a Star Trek podcast. I'm Adam Pranica.
I'm Ben Harrison.
And we are having bad days, both of us. Bad days, bad couple of days.
Yeah.
Things aren't great for us right now, but one thing that I learned again today is the healing power of making this show. I stepped up to the mic and I was like, I'm too cranky for this shit. It's not going to work this time, but it works every time.
Yeah, I always am in a better mood after a recording sesh than I was before. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Sometimes getting drunk has the opposite effect, though. And this is a drunk episode. We did land on a Quark's bar.
It's true.
The last time we rolled the dice.
Terms of the Quark's bar are pretty clear. It's not a like drinking contest or like Century Club situation. It's like two guys at an open bar.
Yeah,
maybe I should say, just talking about an episode of Deep Space Nine.
I think you make a great point, and it makes me want to break out in song, to be quite frank. Making pot about Star Trek today is sometimes less than great. The game of buttholes, will of the prophet, deals cruel twists of fate. Wouldn't you like to drink some beer? Sometimes you wanna go where every Shimoda is drunk, and your friend can take a dunk. You wanna have bad bit moments with friends who've done the same, and talk like Kern without feeling insane. You wanna go where friends of DeSoto are more than just Adam and Ben. You wanna do a drunkisode of Greatest Gen. Alright, I don't have a second verse written.
Wow. That was great. We didn't pre-plan that at all. That is amazing.
I will tell you that just peek behind the pod curtain, I wrote that in between recording an episode of Greatest Discovery, which we just finished like 10 minutes ago, and this.
That is fantastic.
And I also figured out a way to play a song that we could both hear.
That was like magic. Shocked by that.
Yeah.
Aren't you an anti-karaoke? Is that a thing that I know about you, or am I confusing you with someone else?
I have done karaoke a few times. I kind of feel weird about doing karaoke in a private karaoke context, because I feel like it kind of goes against the ethos of it. But I also don't know enough songs well enough to do it in public, so
it's weird how like the private karaoke intimacy heightens the risk. I much prefer an open karaoke bar to that.
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of people who feel exactly the opposite.
Yeah,
one thing that we have learned about ourselves since starting this project, I would say even, is that we're fans of being in front of a crowd. You know.
Oh yeah, huge fan of that.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
No, you're totally right. It's weird to contrast reluctance to private karaoke and 50,000 downloads of a Greatest Gen episode.
Yeah.
I don't know how that squares, but yeah. Here we are. Is that the private room or is that the public room? I think we've interrogated this and it is the public room, right?
Well, That is. I don't want to compare myself to like Seinfeld. Like, I don't want to talk to one person.
Why would you do that? It's insane.
I don't want to talk to one person, but I love talking to a room full of people or whatever. But
wasn't that an Al Gore thing too? Isn't that like what his deal was? He was so bad. In small groups, but great on big stages.
A lot of people don't realize that they were roommates at Yale.
What?
No.
God, I was so ready to believe that.
Al Gore was roommates with Tommy Lee Jones.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
But I love the idea of confusing Tommy Lee Jones with Jerry Seinfeld.
Tommy Lee Jones has heard Al Gore crank it. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Tommy Lee Jones has disregarded a gym sock hung on the door and walked in on Al and Tipper going at it.
I don't know what to make of that.
I was never caught cranking it in college. It seems like a situation fraught with that kind of danger.
Yeah. Were you in a dorm where it was just a door onto a hallway? Or
yeah.
Okay. Because my dorms were always, it was always like there was a living room, a kitchen, and a bathroom, and then there were two bedrooms, and each bedroom was two beds, you know? Like, I feel like the risk of getting caught cranking it is substantially reduced when you have a bedroom door that can be locked that doesn't lead to the hallway.
Yeah.
Anyways, I've thought a lot about this.
I think one way to pivot in the episode is to give ourselves the opportunity to describe what we're drinking. In my case, I am drinking the Green Room, which is, to you and me, just a great big tequila soda in a giant frosty mug that I got out of my freezer.
Oh, wow. You do mug in the freezer.
I do mug in the freezer.
Do you put beer in your freezer mugs?
I almost never do that, but lately I have been using them more and more, and I don't know what got into me.
Because I think beer, like serious beer people, which are, you know, I don't think you should live your life like a serious beer person. That's not what I'm saying. But serious beer people frown on the ice cold glassware because there's a precipitate that comes out of beer when it touches an ice cold surface, and you get the little flakes in your beer.
I have serious beer people in my life. Some of my best friends are serious beer people, which is what allows me to say what I'm about to say.
That is the classic defense of somebody who is serious beer personist.
I like to be refreshed from my beverages, and those people can fuck off with their beer temperatures. I would rather have mine cold. Thank you.
Speaking of being refreshed, I'm drinking a Victory Brewery Summer Love Golden Ale.
That sounds nice and porchy.
Yeah, it's good. I really like the Victory family of products. Their Pilsner is one of my favorite beers in the whole wide world.
Love a Pilsner.
I don't drink a ton of beer these days.
Yeah, me neither.
I've really drastically cut back on most alcohol and beer in particular, but I figured for a Quirks bar, I would crack a couple of brew dogs with my buddy Adam. Do you want to get into the episode?
Yeah, let's get into it. Kind of a serious one today as we talk about Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 21, For the Cause.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
We open in Captain Sisko's bedroom and the triangular pillows of his bed.
Sisko is having sleepovers with Cassidy Yates at this point in their relationship. Things have really progressed.
You think he's putting a sock on his door? Because he's living with Jake, of course.
Jake should move out.
He should.
Jake is old enough that he should have his own place in a moneyless society where the economic pressure of that is not stupendous.
I feel like that episode is coming. It has to be coming.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder.
But there never seems to be any of that tension in their roommate relationship.
Right. Yeah, ever. Jake is not like a slob. He doesn't have annoying teenager habits.
Yeah.
He is very slightly rebellious in that he doesn't want the career his dad always imagined he would have, but he's not like, fuck, dad! You know, he's not the impetuous teen.
No, and he's not running the station out of hot water with his shower jacking either.
I know.
He's a little bit asexual as a teenager, which is, I mean, some people are, but weird for a show in the mid-90s to make a teenager such a great roommate, which he really is.
Yeah. Weirdly asexual for somebody who goes on as many Dabo Girl dates as he does.
Right. Ben, does Cassidy use a device to change her clothes and style her hair? Because there's a little bit of a magic trick in the scene.
Yeah.
Where she gets up from bed wearing one thing, and then she leans in for a kiss wearing something else.
Yeah, she has that that Chanel eye box that that Lilu uses in The Fifth Element.
I like this bit of magic. It's not even referred to as a thing. It's so subtle that you might not even notice that it's happened. There's no sound effect to it.
Yeah.
She just steps out and steps back in. Maybe too subtle for its own good.
Sisko really likes the way this lady smells, because the second she's out of the room, he chucks his own triangle for hers.
He gets under the sheets and smells the spot.
I am a Starfleet officer.
Pervy Sisko.
Jeez.
Get in there and root around, man.
Gross.
We cut to the wardroom, and it's Eddington leading a McLaughlin group.
Issue one.
Which seems a little unique and fun.
Unique and fun, not just in that, but also in that he is delivering a McLaughlin group about highly sensitive Starfleet information.
Right. Two people like Worf and Dax and Kira, like bangers, are in this room.
Yeah. This is your senior staff, and Eddington, who I guess as a lieutenant commander, is privy to some pretty highly classified shit that the rest of the gang needs to be briefed on.
Yeah, which is also weird, right? Like, why is he the only one who knows this stuff?
Why all the secrecy?
I don't know. I mean, like, the episode where he betrayed Sisko, he was doing it on behalf of some Starfleet admiral, right?
Yeah.
So, presumably, he's got communications channels with Starfleet security. But you'd think that, like, Worf would also have those.
Maybe Worf turns off his comm badge when he goes to sleep in the little D.
Oh, yeah. Cell reception is terrible out there.
So let's see if we can recap this meeting. Eddington's in there saying that there's a shipment of industrial replicators that the Federation is secretly sending to the Cardassian civilian government. And ordinarily, this wouldn't be a big deal, but they need to keep this on the down low, because if the Maquis find out about it, they're going to want to intercept them, take them, or destroy them. They're not going to want to allow this to happen. And there's this demilitarized zone that separates the Federation from the Cardassians, and it's right next to the Badlands, and it's just a whole confluence of complexity.
Yeah.
Here. Well,
and the DMZ is the disputed territory where the Maquis are so cranky about where the lines got drawn in the peace treaty.
And if you'll recall, like, the Maquis' whole deal is to disrupt the relationship between the Federation and the Cardassians, because they are the aggrieved party.
Yeah.
They've been the ones many times who've been asked to leave their planet for the sake of a treaty. This is the whole Cal Hudson thing.
Right. And the case that Eddington is making is that the fact that the Cardassians are so busy defending themselves from the Klingons all the time leaves them fairly vulnerable to the Maquis. Like, the Maquis are actually a not insubstantial threat to the Cardassians now that they have to fight a conventional war in addition to the insurgent war.
Sisko does the math on the situation. He's like, transport ships, the little D, why, I think I'll assign Worf to this mission. And so he does. He puts Worf right back on the little D and sends them out.
Aye, sir.
What are you doing?
You know, Adam, there is a case to be made, though, that Worf is the best person for this job now, because he's had a pretty major fuck-up. He's feeling the heat from that. He's like the least likely person to shoot a 737 out of the sky full of civilians.
Quark asks him later, like, what would happen if he had to shoot the shipment of replicators? Worf's like, I hope I get to. Sounds great. I mean, I learned a valuable lesson a couple of episodes ago, and I will definitely not shoot a transport ship.
That's the briefing, and everybody clears out, but Odo and Eddington stick around. They've got something fairly sensitive that they want to talk to Sisko about, and that is this. They have developed some fairly compelling circumstantial evidence that Cassidy Yates may be selling shit to the Maquis.
Captain Sisko is rightly incredulous about this and wants proof immediately, but there isn't really much of it. These are suspicions. This is not an accusation, and that is a parsing of words that they actually do in this scene.
Right. They don't bring an Octopip Admiral in and interrogate it fully, but the suspicion is there. And one thing that is discussed is, like, maybe we should step up our surveillance of her and really, like, go into her shit. And he says, like,
you can't just invade her privacy based on your suspicions.
And Eddington says something outrageous in this moment. He says,
if she's really a Marquis, then she's no longer a Federation citizen.
Yeah.
That is not how due process works.
It's not, but it sounds contemporaneous to
extraordinary rendition. Yeah. Except for this predates that, you know,
yeah.
as like a thing that people were talking about politically. Like, it's a pretty terrifying idea, right? That the second your loyalty is deemed to have flagged an iota, you've foregone all of the, like, rights and responsibilities of citizenship.
Pretty interesting concept that Eddington's alluding to here.
Especially for him.
Yeah, it's interesting that it comes from his mouth. And right, I think that it does.
I wonder what to make of it. Like, is that actually true? Or are there, like, people in Federation security who have leave unilaterally to determine that somebody has forsaken their citizenship? If so, that's fucking terrifying. And the Federation is not the utopia we've been led to believe it is.
Sisko is nervous in this scene for another reason, and that's because the Zhoja...
Why am I here?
...is purported to have been in contact with the Maquis, and Sisko's cargo has been in that ship. He kind of itches himself uncomfortably with that knowledge. that ship has been around.
Ooh. I hope they're packing a vest for the Zhoja.
Odo presents a plan to sort of step up surveillance, but Sisko kind of dismisses this out of hand. And then, like, right before Odo and Eddington leave, he sort of obliquely recommends a search of her ship under the cover of some sort of other thing.
Right. And Odo's like,
I wish I could, but one of my best transportation investigators is no longer on the station.
So we got a sporting event on the station, Adam.
Yeah.
This has happened once or twice before. It's definitely like an established fact that people spectate racquetball, but it seems like now they are spectating live in person. It's not on closed circuit TV from Quark's bar anymore.
Kira kicks the ass of whoever she's playing in spring ball, and I want to know who she's playing.
I know.
You never know.
It really seemed like that person was going to take their helmet off and we were going to get like a big hilarious reveal.
Yes! Well played!
It's Guinan.
We know that Guinan would have won if it had been Guinan. Yeah.
Really weird. This is a scene that's all about Garrick and Zial. Zial, who looks a little different now because she's played by someone else, and they're sharing glances, which could be seen to imply either an attraction or a suspicion between them.
I wondered why Zial got recast. I thought that the lady in that part was great.
Yeah, I thought so too. Not that new Zial isn't, but this episode is in close proximity to the other one. It's weird to do a recast like 4 episodes apart or whatever.
I mean, I agree that this performance is also good. And the Loaf does a lot of this, but she does look a lot like the other lady, I want to say.
Yeah. There is no like satisfying conclusion to this scene. It's Bashir telling Garrick to take it easy on Zial.
Right.
And to pay more attention to the game.
The case is made that Garrick is quite curious about Zial's presence on the station, and that is potentially hazardous to him because if it's not Gul Dukat that would kick his ass, it's Kira.
Yeah, why would you want the trouble? She doesn't seem worth it.
I wouldn't play around with her if I were you.
I kind of feel like they should make a Deep Space Nine cookbook, Ben, of all of Ben Sisko's abominations. Because the next scene...
Everything is just cut up carrots badly.
So what he's making is a stew on top of spinach linguine.
That looks like the inside of a diaper.
And what he's putting on top as a garnish is cubed carrots, raw.
Or maybe butternut squash? not a thing that would be good.
There's like a fun bit of dialogue here between Cassidy and Sisko where Ben Sisko's like, I'm making this monstrosity. And I think, is it Cassidy or is it Jake? One of them is like, yeah, like your neighbors love smelling your cooking down the hall. And I mean, I know we've both lived in apartment buildings where you could smell someone else's cooking. That never smells good.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Nobody's cooking smells good through a door.
Yeah.
It's funny, right? Because like you walk into somebody's house that's cooking and it's always exciting, you know?
Yeah.
But
it doesn't work.
If you smell it through a door, somehow doors filter out whatever is pleasurable about smelling cooking.
The doors change everything.
Who understands that?
I don't know.
Sisko is not slick in this scene because he keeps kind of trying to pussyfoot around what she might be doing on her next run. She is a trucker, essentially. And he's like, so heading through Montana on that next run. Any chance you're going to be in Billings-ish?
What route do you take to the Dreon system?
I think if there's one thing we know about Ben Sisko is that subtlety is not his strong suit.
Don't you make a regular cargo run to a neighboring system?
Yeah.
At any level.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Right.
Like, how did he ever get with Cassidy Yates to begin with?
It's funny because I think that Avery Brooks actually does have a great command of subtlety in some of the choices he makes in performing this character, but the character has no subtlety.
Right.
Which is really funny.
I wonder how frustrating that is for an actor to be capable of something like that and to play a character who isn't.
I don't know. I kind of get the feeling it's a choice, though.
Yeah. We cut to a very brief turbo lift scene where Garrick runs into Zial, and that meet cute happens where everyone else but them gets off of a turbo lift.
Yeah.
And they flirt and joke about their mutual need not to fear each other. Which is how Cardassians flirt, right?
Yeah. The upshot is them assuring each other that neither has anything to fear from knowing each other. And that's a pretty dangerous footing to start any kind of relationship on, even if it's just friendship.
It would have been too ham and cheese to have just put Morn on the turbo lift and then he gets off having just crop dusted it.
Do you think Morn rips particular ass?
Oh man, with how much he drinks? Yeah, yes. He
probably farts pretty badly.
I feel like he's got to be a gassy guy. But like before, there is no strong resolution to this relationship. They sort of agree not to fear each other and then they go their separate ways.
We've learned a lot about the intentions with which Andrew Robinson was playing Garrick recently.
Right.
That Garrick is sort of coded as not straight. They never come out and say it in the series, but I wonder how this reads from a queer viewing of the show, because I never get the sense that Garrick is interested in a romantic relationship with Zial. But I'm watching it from an unsophisticated, like, cis, straight, white guy standpoint. Because I think Bashir, at least in the writing, is definitely concerned that Garrick wants to bang Zial.
The way I saw it was that any romance derived from them looking at each other was on the part of Zial in her receiving of the male gaze and not Garrick in his giving of that. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like she's taking it in what could be interpreted as a romantic fashion, but it's not being transmitted that way. But I don't think we're retconning that based on what we know from what Andrew Robinson has said about his character. Like, I feel like it's in the show.
Yeah. I mean, he might actually be attracted to her. I just don't know. Yeah. I don't know what to make of it. And I wondered if he's gay, then this whole scene reads as much funnier in some ways, because, like, you know, it's a friendship flirt, but maybe being misinterpreted by everybody but them as something more than that.
Also, like, attraction can be not romantic.
Right.
I for a while, I worked in an office building where I was one of like six people my age. Like everyone else was in like their 40s and 50s, and then like half a dozen of us were in our 20s.
Yeah.
And like you are attracted to being around people that are of similar ages or backgrounds. And I feel like if you're one of two Cardassians on the station, there's going to be an attraction there. And it may not be romantic, but like they want to know each other.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the implication, regardless of whether or not anything's loaded romantically here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, down in the docking ring, the Zhouzhou is being held up for 6 hours by station security.
I'm really tired of being insulted.
Who are claiming that they need to do a level 2 inspection of Cassidy Yates' cargo because of a virus that has broken out on Bajor. And she is complaining to Odo that that's going to really fuck their schedule up. They're trying to make a connecting flight in Minneapolis, and they're not going to catch it if they leave 6 hours from now.
This Temeculan virus that they're scanning for, Ben, you can pick it up in a place like an antique store or an old town district.
Uh-huh.
Before you know it, you're just going to take that back to Murrieta.
I have no idea what you did there.
Talking about Temecula, the city in Southern California, Ben.
Temecula Canyon?
It's known for the surrounding Temecula Valley wine country.
Uh-huh.
With its hillside vineyards and many golf courses.
Okay.
I'm just shouting out my listeners in Temecula, Ben.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What up, Temecula? Temecula in the house!
Look out for our Greatest Gen Tour hitting Old Town Temecula and the Holiday Inn Express there.
Yeah, yeah. The booking agent dropped us shortly after we announced our intention to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're booking ourselves. It's nothing but Victorville and Temecula all the way down.
We are not good at business.
Cassidy is so pissed at the idea of being detained here that she actually goes to Captain Sisko on a FaceTime and asks to be let out of it. And this is such an interesting scene, Ben, because I completely understand why she would do it, but she does it basically in front of Odo and the security team.
Right.
Like, they should be insulted by this whole, like, if mom says no, ask dad thing that she does. But you never get that part of the conflict.
I wonder about this. Like, my wife works for an influential politician, and I always wonder, like, if she got pulled over, could she drop that and, like, get the cop to let her go? You know, if she got pulled over for speeding and said the right thing, would it make a difference? But she's the kind of person that would never, ever, ever in a zillion years do that in that context. It's just not how she rolls.
Hmm.
But Cassidy definitely is still making eye contact with Odo while she's on FaceTime with Sisko going,
Ben, please.
I respect that motivation from her, but like neither is there a bit of conflict on her end in her background, nor is there one from Ben Sisko going, Cassidy, you're really putting me into a pickle here.
Right.
You're really breaking my balls here.
I gotta write reports about this to my superiors and explain why this one ship got released from this regulation.
And this is an area where subtlety, I don't think, serves the moment. Because if that exists here, it's so subtle as to not even be felt.
Right. So she gets to go, but
yeah, he makes it happen.
Yeah, but the little D is on her tail and cloaked.
Yeah.
It is Alpha Quadrant cloaked to sneak after the captain's girlfriend.
I love the context clue of this sequence, Ben, because we never see, like, blurry exterior little D. Instead, we see all of the stations in that cloaked blue.
Yeah.
And this is something we've been taught as viewers for the last couple seasons.
Yeah, the lighting on the bridge changes when they're under cloak.
Sisko changes his soup from a hot soup to a gazpacho.
Yeah. So suddenly he's having a Vichy Soise soup.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You don't want to work the microwaves while you're under cloak, Ben. That'll
give
your position away.
Let off all kinds of emissions.
that are detectable.
Little D's orders are to follow the Zhouzhou and only take pictures.
Ew. Seriously?
Ben, and this is one of the most fun missions, I think, in movies or television.
Yeah. O'Brien is doing a thing on the bridge of talking about controversial politics with his coworkers.
That's why he doesn't get invited to dinner parties.
Yes.
Outside of his decision not to attend dinner parties.
No kidding. Like, and also just like lipping off to Worf.
They should be hunted down and destroyed.
What for? Defending their homes?
He's talking about the Maquis, and Worf is like, I would never become a terrorist, even in the context in which the Maquis became terrorists. And O'Brien's like, well, I wouldn't tell that to Major Kira. Come on, man. That's your boss. He's a lieutenant commander. You're a fucking enlisted man. Like, you can't do that.
Eddington is great in this scene because he knows not to talk about these matters while at work.
And I like that they resisted the temptation to, like, put the camera in Eddington's face and show him...
Right.
Grimacing as they talked about it.
It's in keeping with his character. Like, he's the try-hard, annoying guy. Like,
yeah.
And it doesn't tip you off.
But they also, like, let you forget that he's there a little bit. Like, it seems like it's just going to be an O'Brien Worf scene.
Yeah.
And then O'Brien turns, and it's kind of, like, almost a reveal that Eddington is also sitting on the bridge.
The real revelation of this scene is that a Maquis raider pulls up to Cassidy's ship and receives its cargo.
Yeah.
The suspicion has been confirmed.
At this point, no matter what happens in the episode, we know that Cassidy is working with the Maquis in some capacity.
I didn't want to believe it, Ben, but, I mean, here it is. Alma Marin, come to Fort. Alma Marin, come to Fort.
What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing now? Exactly.
It's such a brutal truth that, like, even after this, like, for the rest of the episode, I was trying to do the Rubik's Cube of, like, how are they going to get the blood off of Cassidy's hands?
Yeah.
Like, that's the kind of ship that the Maquis use, but it wasn't a Maquis, it was somebody else, or she was deceived into doing that. She didn't know what she was transporting or to whom.
It wasn't me. It was the one-armed man.
You know, something like that. Like, if it was that, if it was she didn't know, it makes her look like an idiot and a rube.
Yep.
Which
and
is...
And you can't have that either.
That would dishonor that character, you know? She's not an idiot.
No.
But I was trying to make her an idiot because I didn't want to believe. And I think that that's, like, a very powerful, like, a really sophisticated and cool storytelling idea.
I think the B story here struggles to rise to the tension of the A story, because back at Garrick's, Zial has visited his tailor shop and she invited him for a Cardassian schwitz.
Yeah.
Because she has the honey stick of a Cardassian sauna holosuite program and she doesn't want to go alone.
Yeah, she got the Burke Williams honey stick. And I guess the Cardassians are always a little bit chilly around everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Their desired temperature is quite a bit higher than that of other humanoids, so their sauna program would be, like, lethal to anybody but a Cardassian.
Yeah.
But it sounds like a date, right? Like, sauna is a pretty sexy first date.
I was wondering if you might be interested in trying it out with me.
Yeah.
It's either sexy or gross, right?
Yeah, if it's not nude, then it's actually a lot more gross, because I can't believe that what they're wearing is going to be very breathable.
It made me wonder, like, does Garrick have, like, electric blankets sewn into his clothes?
Oh, interesting take.
Because it would be really fun if Garrick was always wearing, like, a parka, you know? It'd
be weird if all Cardassians had sort of, like, a spit valve at the bottom of their clothes.
Let all the sweat out?
Gross. You never see Garrick sweat, though.
No.
Maybe they don't sweat.
He is real stunned when she drops this invitation off, though.
Yeah.
Might be the only time we've seen him really off his guard in a major way.
He takes her up on it, though.
Yeah.
No reason not to.
That's Gul Dukat's daughter.
Jake and his dad are breakfasting the next day, and
Jake is ordering some weird garbage out of the replicator, and Cisco's like, what the fuck are you eating? Jake is like, oh, this is a great breakfast that Cassidy told me about.
Have you heard of Mentos and Diet Coke? It's my new breakfast.
You know how Cassidy makes a foamy white substance come out of you? Look at this. She also makes it come out of my breakfast.
Gross. This breakfast irritates Captain Sisko.
What happened to juice and oatmeal?
The very idea of it is disgusting to him.
There's a lot of classified information at play here that he cannot divulge to Jake.
Instead, he gets a weird dad, which is almost worse, right?
Yeah.
Like, if he were to just tell Jake the truth, it would be less weird than, Jake, I want you to have all my things if something bad were to happen to me. The weird handshake, like the lingering hug.
Yeah. Jake is like, Dad, are you drunk?
Like, I'm sorry about breakfast, Dad.
What's with this I love you man routine?
I'll go back to oatmeal and orange juice if you'll just be normal with me again.
We don't need to become blood brothers. You're my dad.
Yeah, weird. Jake's like, this would be a bad time to ask for my own apartment. Dad's seeming very clingy right now. And you know when you know shit is bad when you're accusing Ben Sisko of being clingy, because that level of clinginess is bonkers.
Yeah. At the McLaughlin group
issue two,
they are talking about what to do about this Cassidy Yates issue, and it looks like what she was transporting to them was either medical supplies or food.
As we've seen from Jake's breakfast, food can be weaponized.
Yeah.
You never know what kind of foam is going to be deployed by the Makeweez later.
Right. But it's still a really bad look, and Ben is very pissed off. Dax wants to stop and talk it out with him, and he's even a dick to her.
Dismissed, old man.
Where's Kira? It feels like it's odd that she's been sidelined from all this.
It's a episode where I wanted Sisko and Dax to talk more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an episode where I wanted Kira's perspective more. And I think that it's an episode that's aware that it's missing those two things.
Yeah.
You know, like the don't tell Kira about your opinions about terrorists, Worf scene.
Right.
Telegraphs the Kira element, and the dismissed old man with Sisko telegraphs the Dax thing. Like,
I did miss the special relationship between Kira and Sisko, though, where they tend to talk about hard shit.
Yeah.
And that she's never being confided in. It would have been interesting to me. There's just no time.
There's just no time. It's a single episode arc.
Yeah. Sisko sees the evidence and he is totally crushed. Like, that's the big takeaway here, is that, like, it's incontrovertible. It's real, and it's bad.
It's real, and it's bad, and he has to kind of keep on a smiling face because Cassidy is back at the station, and she comes to see him. You know, she's got another cargo run to make that night, but she wants to hang out for a minute in between cargo runs, and he can't divulge to her what he knows.
I think this is my favorite scene of the episode because it's pregnant with that breakup energy, like where one person is acting like everything's normal and the other person is so clearly not down. And
yeah,
like it felt like a breakup was on the table here in this scene, and it doesn't happen.
But like, that's such a real thing, right?
Like, so intense.
One person has checked out already but hasn't mustered the courage to say it yet.
It was really well done. And they don't ham up Sisko's performance here either. Like, he is as subtle as he can get. And you can tell, like, she lies to Sisko's face. Like, she lies to him 5 or 6 times in a row about where she's been and what she's going to do. And she's specific about it.
Yeah.
And, like, that specificity makes it so ugly.
They've got some kind of viral infection on one of their colonies. In fact, I can't stay long. I'm supposed to make a run tonight.
It's specificity that betrays a certain amount of guile, right?
It's breakup energy, but it's also affair energy, right?
Yeah. Like, she has a very specific cover story.
Yeah.
Jake comes in with a honey stick of his own, and this is a fantasy baseball game between different eras of Yankees and Red Sox.
And Ben declines to go on this third wheel date. So I guess Cassidy and Jake just go on the date together.
Baseball games are long. Like, they just go and watch a baseball game for 3 hours?
Yeah.
Okay.
They can zip by if you get enough $18 beers.
Yeah. So, you can't get smashed on hollow sweet beers, though.
How much does a baseball game beer cost in Seattle?
I want to say like $10. It would be would be like the middle. I think you can get a beer at a Mariner game for $8, and I think you can get a beer for $12. Like, I think there's room to play in the middle of those.
I think the cheapest beer at Dodger Stadium is $16.
Oof. That's why you bring your works in. Save the beer money and just bring in your spoon.
I just jazz gum before the game, you know?
God, that's just a nice day outside. The help of a little jazz gum.
Yeah. Jazz gum, father-in-law, Dodger dog.
Panama.
To be quite honest about it, I was in a pail. Mr. Bucket, I have to revert back to my limited state. I don't use the bucket anymore.
Yeah, so with them sidelined, it's really like the Eddington Cisco Little D show.
I had a problem with this Eddington Cisco scene because the default commander of the Defiant, as far as show canon is concerned, is Worf.
Yep.
And they have this conversation like, Eddington is like, well, if I'm here looking after these replicators that are coming through on this big shipment, who is going to command the Defiant? And Cisco's like, I guess I have to do it.
I mean, in retrospect, if Eddington isn't able to make the case for the crew complement being split the way that it's decided, I think his plan sort of fizzles.
Yeah, the idea that Worf and Cisco both need to be on the little D, he needs that to be ironclad.
But what is so persuasive from Eddington is that he makes the case that he doesn't want to have to make a battlefield decision that is related in any way to a Cassidy Yates. And right. He's right. But also he's wrong, because the one person who is worse for that situation is probably Ben Cisco, right?
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm going to put a hat on top of that hat. The one person who is worst of all is Worf, who has
That's where I thought you were going, to be honest.
Who has a history of shooting transport ships when they shouldn't be shot.
Yeah.
So Cassidy Yates is in mortal danger.
Yeah. She's in mortal danger, and I think maybe suspects it.
Yeah, because of this airlock scene, right?
Yeah, he walks down and says, like, hey, why don't the two of us just get away from everything, run off to Ryza?
We won't even pack a bag. We'll walk straight out of here, get in a runabout, and go.
Your crew's good, my crew's good. They can handle things without us. And she's like, I know that what we're about to do is super dangerous, but it's not runabout to Ryza dangerous, so no.
To borrow a bit of Temerian language here, Ben, this is really a scene of Pacino and De Niro at the diner in Heat.
Yeah.
Cassidy knowing, like, she's been made.
Mm-hmm.
And Cisco can't do anything about it yet.
The Temerians really love that movie. And really, like, all of Michael Mann's work. Even some of the more uneven later stuff, you know?
Did you also see it as Cassidy knowing?
Yeah, I think that's in there. Like, I think her character is really savvy, you know?
Yeah. She'd have to be caught up in as the go-between here.
Right. I think that the thing that happens in this story is that Cisco and Cassidy are both so invested in their belief systems and in their love for each other that they kind of are blind to the world happening around them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the little D follows the Zhoja into the Badlands.
Stop chasing me!
And it is Odo that puts it together.
Yeah.
This doesn't make any fucking sense, because the Zhoja is just like in a holding pattern, hanging out for hours and hours waiting for their contact. And he's like, this is not the slick, dead drop terrorist shit that we have come to know the Maquis for.
Think about it. If anyone but Cassidy Yates was on the Zosa, would you be commanding this mission yourself?
This is a good Odo scene in a good Odo episode. In a season that I feel like has done a lot of work in disputing how good Odo is at his job.
Yeah.
Like it's good to be reminded that, like, he has a job and he's good at it, and this scene is an example of that.
One main cast character that does not fit into the Eddington plan of getting them all on the little D is Kira, She's got a couple of more story beats back aboard the station. One is slamming Garrick up against a wall.
If you do anything to hurt her, I will make you regret it. Is that clear?
If he tries anything funny with Zial. And the other is her getting shot by Eddington. Because he needs to take over and not have her interfering with his evil plan.
This scene is shot in such a way that, like, there's something baked into the compositional DNA of it where you know someone is going to be shot here. Did you get that?
Yeah, it's like Old West town, empty street somehow.
Yeah, I agree.
He phasers Kira, and then he turns and phasers a pot of mashed potatoes, leaving just the whisk and the potatoes. And he walks out of the room and locks the door. He explained to the Starfleet security yellow shirts that there's a little bit of a change of plan with the replicators. They're going to load them up onto a Vulcan ship. And we actually get to see this Vulcan ship like plugged into the station.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, it just looks like a heap of laundry. Like it is such an indistinct ship.
It's built for utility and not style.
Yeah, that is all happening while they're putting it together on the little D out in the Badlands. Like, they beam over to the Zsozsa.
You are tortured by self-doubt and fear.
And Sisko is accusing Cassidy of having drawn them out to expose the station to an attack, which is a much worse thing to suspect her of having done than what she actually has done.
Right. This is just a sad scene, like Cassidy playing dumb and then being turned, like, not great.
And I think that, like, maybe a little bit undercuts some of the work the episode does in not compromising her intelligence.
Agreed.
And I think that would be, like, fairly inexcusable, except for Sisko is also kind of compromised. And I think it is in that way of two people who are in a relationship. Like, sometimes in a fit of anxiety or whatever, we can convince ourselves that our most beloved people are doing something bad against us, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's a real thing that happens in relationships. And the idea that Sisko goes to the worst possible thing for Cassidy to have done is very realistic, I think.
Yeah.
What she's actually done is kind of fall for a big plan that Eddington put into place. Like, she is sympathetic to the Maquis cause and has been used as a pawn by Eddington to draw Sisko away from the station so Eddington can hijack these industrial replicators and disappear into the wind.
If you make her any more intentional, you remove the idea of her being a patsy.
Right.
And it's the only thing that makes her forgivable is that she's being manipulated, right?
Right.
Like, she's irredeemable if she presents as any more motivated than right. She is.
Yeah, because if she's plotting on a level any higher than that, she's a villain.
Yeah, so the little D needs to get back to Deep Space Nine on the double, and it's a little bit creepy because they're hailing and there's no response. And that's because concurrently, Eddington has been briefing Starfleet security about the loading of these replicators and then telling everyone not to communicate with anyone outside the station or even in the station. It's like a radio blackout happening.
He played chess when they thought they were playing checkers, and they get back and the deed has been done. They're talking about it in ops. The major has recovered from her phaser blast, and you know, Sisko's feeling like a real dope, like he got his pants pulled down when a FaceTime comes through from Eddington. And Sisko goes and takes that call in private. And it is a pretty intense, like, villain gloat.
The only reason I've contacted you is to ask you to leave us alone.
I really, really like this scene. And I really, really like the message. I also really like how it's composed, Ben, because Eddington might as well be looking at the viewer here when he indicts Starfleet and paints it in a light that maybe a Star Trek viewer hasn't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
Not to both sides it too much.
What are you, Roderick?
But I get it. And Sisko does not. He is totally closed off to what Eddington is saying here. He does not see that side of the argument at all. And I thought that was just a fascinating difference between the two. Ben Sisko does not have an open mind when it comes to the portrayal of the Federation.
He doesn't, but also Eddington is a zealot, you know? Like, the way Eddington is talking about this, his slavering, he's so fucking ripshit pissed with the Federation.
Yeah.
And he says that the Federation are as bad as the Borg. Like, talk, if we're going to both sides, like, that's,
yeah,
that's as both sidesy as it gets.
Yeah.
And that just isn't true, you know? The Federation made a treaty that didn't work for some people, but generally speaking, the Federation is about providing the most freedom possible for the most people it can. And that's why they're trying to get the Cardassians onto a peaceful footing with them. Like, they want everybody to be in the Federation eventually.
It's interesting that Cal Hudson had a very similar argument and also just totally bounced off of Ben Sisko's comm badge, you know? Like,
yeah.
Ben Sisko's bulletproof to this argument. And it doesn't matter who is presenting it. It could be one of his best friends, or it could be someone he doesn't really like Eddington. It's
yeah,
weird.
Like, you cannot see O'Brien giving voice to the shit he gives voice to in this episode in Ben Sisko's presence, right?
Yeah.
Because O'Brien knows that that would be his ass.
Look, I just found Eddington very persuasive here, and it doesn't mean that I necessarily agree with everything that he said, but, like, the math equals no remainders here. I found his argument compelling, and it made some sense to someone in his position.
Morn.
Dear sweet.
Morn.
You near, buddy?
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
The button on the B story is the sauna hang with Zial and Garrick, and it is a wear your normal walking around clothes into the hot room.
Yeah.
If the producers did not give the costume department budget to develop a Cardassian sauna garb, then that sucks. But if the costume department just neglected to see this as an opportunity to develop that, that sucks. I want to know what the Cardassian bathrobe looks like.
Just give us a bathrobe. It could just be a terry cloth bathrobe. They give Quark a brand new tunic that's made of grandma's wallpaper, like, which is like his sixth one of the season, and they can't, like, go to Costco and get a terry cloth bathrobe for a couple of actors. I think you got to put them in some robes,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. It turns out that Zial's intentions for this were extremely innocent and non-datey, you know?
Yeah.
She was not inviting him on a date. She was inviting him on a, like, let's get together as two people with some similar background, and, like, I want to get to know the planet that I can't live on and that you can't live on. Like, we were both in a lot of ways isolated from our people.
Yeah.
And maybe we can be friends about that.
I mean, I wonder if what we're getting here is a Bashir and Garrick breakfast. Like, is this going to be done on the regular? Who knows?
Yeah. Garrick definitely had all the status in the Bashir and Garrick breakfast.
Yeah.
In the opening volleys of that.
Yeah.
And in this is, he comes to this terrified, right? He comes strapped. He has to, like, put the gun down to enjoy the hang.
You know, I don't want to go back too far, but I wonder if why they're not in robes is because there's a context to that that could skew too far into the romantic area. Like by being close to naked, is that not even a thing that you want to allow into a viewer's mind? Like, because
yeah,
she's significantly younger than he is, for one.
Yeah.
And two, if a romantic entanglement is not something that you want even hinted at, like, you can make that case through clothing.
Yeah, and it's also just really hard to hide a gun in a bathrobe.
Indeed. Gotta grease that thing up. Well, the button on the episode, Ben, is pretty dark, and that's at the airlock. Cassidy Yates has come back alone on her cargo ship. She's left her crew with the Makewees. And she chooses to come back, she says, because of their relationship. Because she still loves him, she has returned. But if you're only watching this scene and not listening to the dialogue, I would find this credible, but she comes back to go to jail.
Yeah.
I don't understand the logic here. Like, what relationship is she preserving by doing this? I think you could make her a very interesting character by making her an outlaw on the run every once in a while, sending FaceTimes to Cisco the way that Eddington did earlier. Why not preserve that tension?
Here's the thing, man. Jail is not prison. Like, there is a little bit of a case to be made that she was deceived.
Yeah.
And she did do some stuff that I think is bad, but it's, you know, she says,
I'll be back.
I don't think that her as an interesting person to introduce to a storyline is over by any means.
You know what's crazy is that her defense lawyer is Ron Canada. When she ends up going to trial. So interesting choice to bring Chapak back.
Yeah, cool.
You really want to do this? Here, now, okay, let's do it,
Did you like the episode, Adam?
Yeah, I think there was a lot to like here.
Did you notice that the security guy that she gets taken into custody by is named Lieutenant Reese?
I did, and it's the same guy that Eddington throws the keys to the station to earlier. He had a big episode.
Do you think that guy is like the son or grandson of Lieutenant Reese from Star Trek Discovery?
I mean, I think we know that the writers' room of Discovery are great big fans of DS9. They've mined it for a lot of trivial information, so maybe. Could see
I just
that.
Like that idea a lot.
I'm here for it. I like the episode's interest in, like, presenting a challenge of dating someone whose political beliefs are different than yours.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the parallel suspicions of a Sisko and Yates and of a Garrick and Zial. There are two great big bangers dropped at the end of this episode, the Eddington thing and the Cassidy Yates thing. It feels like it's a lot of Star Trek in a little Star Trek bag, and I think I tend to like the episodes that really swing for the fences the way this one does. A lot happens here, and I liked it for that reason. What about you?
Yeah, I liked it too. I think there's some uneven stuff and some, you know, like, I wish the way Garrick was intending to relate to Zial had been a little bit more, a little bolder in mm-hmm. the way it was presented.
Mm-hmm.
I think it may have taken some of the drama out of it. This might have been the opportunity to kind of secure, you know, Garrick's legacy as a gay or at least queer character.
Mm.
And I think it's that is preserved in this episode, his coded queerness, but it is not said explicitly, and I think that's too bad. But overall, I think it's a pretty interesting story and a pretty good episode.
Well, one area of our show that is fairly explicit are our priority one messages. What do you say we head over there and see what we've got?
I'm into that.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Ben, our first priority one message is from Stephanie, Eric, Oscar, and Neil, and it is for Andrew. That message goes like this. A shout out to our favorite captain, sending you all the love from your number one and the Ion Collective. We miss you.
Do you think Ion Collective is Eric, Oscar, and Neil, like, as an acronym?
I do believe it is an acronym.
I've had a lot to drink, Adam.
Stephanie does not make the acronym, otherwise it would be the Scion Collective, right?
Stephanie is number one, clearly.
I know. What does it mean?
She's a lieutenant on his ship.
Clearly.
Adam, we have another priority one message here, and it is from Cumron Ingborgs, and it's to Daigle Beamsy.
Hmm.
Goes like this. You strong spaceman ride scooter, ladylike. Me, Big Mr. Hom, kill merchant, no think before swing. You intro me TGG, best thing. Me very happy, Adam and Ben. Racquetball in your court, now Beamsy come drink me with Canar. Ben and Adam, come with Ingborgs and Beamsy, drink us Canar in VT. You will like. Ben and Adam, big fans, take word for it.
Wow. I read that one along with you, and that was every word of it in the correct order. It read like a drunk Priority One message.
Yeah.
Or it's just very deeply coded.
I feel more inebriated having read it than I already did, which was very.
Canar in Vermont sounds great, if that is indeed what Canar in VT means.
Yeah.
Love Vermont.
Yeah, it's a nice state.
Well, if you have a Priority One message of the coded, normal, or commercial nature, you can take it on over to MaximumFun.org/Jobotron, where personal messages are $100, commercial messages are $200, and both of them go a long way in supporting the ongoing production of The Greatest Generation.
Hey, Adam.
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible.
Drunk Shimoda!
I am going to give my drunk Shimoda to Quark, who in his scene with Garrick does not appear to know measurements. He says his pants are a meter too long.
I thought he was just using hyperbole in that moment.
Oh, really? Oh, I took him literally.
Yeah, you might be right. I thought he was just being like a wise ass.
Yeah, I mean, maybe...
Being a wise ass can get you drunk Shimoda, though.
That kind of kneecaps the logic around my Shimoda. Now I don't know if that was correct, but there is no right or wrong in choosing a drunk Shimoda. Ben, what did you pick?
I picked Sisko for keeping Eddington in a position of trust.
Yeah, that was bad.
I think if you are the commander of a space station, you probably have leave to remove somebody from your command if you don't trust them anymore.
Yeah.
And that opening McLaughlin group reveals that Sisko is still letting Eddington take highly controlled information from Starfleet and disseminating it to him and his staff.
Yeah.
Like, I would never want to get information from Eddington about what we're doing.
We saw this coming, too. In that episode where he was double-crossed the first time by Eddington, Sisko's like, hey, anyone wearing that uniform gets second chances from me.
Yeah.
I'm Easy A Ben Sisko. And it came back to bite him in the ass, just like we thought it would.
It would have been great to just have a scene where he goes like, you Cal Hudson'd me, Eddington. You really fucking Cal Hudson'd me.
There's a little bit of that tinged in the scenes later, but Sisko is responsible for this fuck up.
Yeah.
That is a strong Shimoda, Ben.
Gotta get that gold press lap. Get that
gold press lap.
Am I right?
Well, we need to find out what we're watching for the next episode and how we're going to watch it. For that, we consult the Game of Buttholes, Will of the Prophets.
We sure do.
What are we watching, Ben?
We are watching Season 4, Episode 22, To the Death. Attempting to stop a group of Jem'Hadar renegades from gaining power, Sisko and the Defiant crew must join forces with deadly Jem'Hadar soldiers.
That sounds like fun.
Enemy of my enemy.
I can dig that.
But we also have to find out how we are watching it, Adam.
It's true. Currently, we are on square 18, which is the Quark's Bar square. Three squares ahead is a space butthole, and a few squares ahead of that is an explodey box.
A banger.
Which would move the runabout five spaces back.
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
And here I go. I have rolled a 2.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
That is a 2. It gets us to square 20, right on the doorstep of that space butthole. Just the rim of it, Ben. The most sensitive part.
We could hit that Temerian metaphor square again.
I know. People were a big, big fan of that.
Some people hated it.
Yeah, I was joking.
Like, any square we hit that isn't a regular square, we will get
hate mail about.
Yeah, that's fine.
And, hey, let me just put this out there. Don't sue us in the court of Judge John Hodgman because you didn't like a square we hit.
Well put, Ben.
That is never going to make it to air. Like, that will never become a podcast episode.
You wasted John Hodgman's time and you're wasting ours.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, one thing that's never a waste of time, Ben, is thanking the many people who make this show possible. Of course, that starts with you and me. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Adam.
Couldn't do without you.
This is always a highlight of my week.
Yeah, it's all downhill from here. Gotta thank some of the other people who make this show possible. We use a lot of the work of Adam Ragusea. He is a person who has created the music for our Star Trek properties and otherwise, really.
Yep.
And he often chops and screws the work of the great Dark Materia, the progenitor of our podcast music.
We should thank Bill Tilley, who makes trading cards about every episode we do. And J.J. Lendl, who makes a movie poster for every episode we're about to review. You can find all of that if you use the hashtag GreatestGen on Twitter. Bill Tilley has also set up a Tumblr for the trading cards. I think it's BillTilley1973.tumblr.com. Did I have that right?
That's correct as far as I know.
It's the sexiest thing on Tumblr that isn't actual sex. He's like currently going through and adding old cards to the Tumblr, which he'll do slowly, but the cards are great and I love looking at them.
The podcasts that Ben and I make represent our full-time job, a job for which we need to derive a salary to continue. If you want to support our work, you can go to MaximumFun.org/donate.
Yeah, if this is a highlight of your week the way it is for us, if it makes your Monday commute a little bit easier, or if you just want to make sure that it keeps going and has a future, you can really make a big difference in that by going to MaximumFun.org/donate and contributing. And even when it's not the Max Fun Drive, you get gifts for your support, not least of which is all of the bonus content. We have tons and tons of bonus episodes up there for your listening pleasure.
You want to make tours happen? MaximumFun.org/donate. That's how you can do it. Maybe even whispers of a tour. Just, you can smell them.
Yeah.
Smell the whispers, Ben.
Yeah. Is it going to be Star Trek 3? Who knows?
I think that's about it, Ben. With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine. There's a bit of an odd couple feel to it. We're the ultimate Star Trek odd couple, right, Ben?
Yeah, you and me.
Yeah, you're the lemon and I'm the Matthew, I think. I think that's got to be how it is. There's no other way to see it.
Yeah.
I could see myself being a lemon, though.
I could see myself being a Matthew in a lot of ways, you know?
I think there are aspects to lemon and Matthew in us both.
I could see myself finding you've put a rotting fish in the back of my car.
Yeah, that seems like something I would do. All right, we'll adjudicate this on the next episode.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.